we're going to switch to English. And so let me introduce you our guest tonight. Daniel MacLean. Daniel MacLean is a... I'm introducing him. He's a curator and lawyer. Seth Sigalow, which I don't think we have to introduce. So many things you're doing. He's been a gallerist, a well-known publisher of conceptual art, so-called conceptual art, which is something we could discuss. Textile collector and bibliographer, and now interested mostly in temporality. And
Time and space.
Dexter Sinister, whose exhibition is here.
That's close enough.
David Rayford and Stuart Bailey. So, good evening, everybody.
I'm going to start off here, simply because I'm the oldest.
And I'm the most famous.
And I've been around the block a few times, more times than most people. What I'm going to talk about concerns the book. When I was active in the art world, which is now 40, 45 years ago, I was very involved with the artists, which is, say, now known as conceptual artists, involved with producing, giving a book another dimension than it had had before in the art world. I've always been a great fan of books. I think books are here to stay. I don't think digital experiences has replaced them or even will replace them. And I wanted to have a little discussion about what the problems that I had as a small publisher, which you can call, most of my activities concerning the book. One of the problems that everyone has in producing a book, I won't get involved particularly with the so-called conceptual art book necessarily, which is a subtopic of certain kind of printed paper production. But one of the problems that this society has a difficult time digesting is the production of small edition, very specifically oriented books for a public. It is extremely difficult, or at least I found this particularly difficult, to produce a book and to be able to find its public, if you like, to be able to live from it, which people have a right to do, producing objects. And one of the things that I found particularly important in my experience at that time, which is to say in the late 60s and to the early 70s, and later with the different kinds of political books and whatever, is to be able to distribute a book. And this was a very specific problem which small books, small publishers, non-profit, unprofitable books have to deal with 24 hours a day once they have... Is that okay? So? Okay, then I should sit up a minute. Is the problem of distribution of books, it got worse again. Is to be able to distribute a book. It was only after that I was particularly involved with the art world or production of books or catalogs, whatever you want to call them, that they developed a network or possible network for means to distribute the books. When I was active in bookmaking, not to be confused with bookmakers and betting shops in England, the problem that I had was, and I dare say we had, which includes the artist, was be able to get the books out to a public. There was no networks, or there was no places at that time to be able to distribute a book. Now, it would be very nice to be able to produce books, small edition of books, a very specialized nature, and be able to find a public that could possibly be interested in them. And this was our problem, as it probably still is today, with contemporary bookmaking, out of a artistic, let's call it, a small edition of publishing, which is of which art books are one part of. There's also poetry books. There's also a whole series of specialized publications which also have the same problem. It is very clear that we live in a world where mass marketing and a certain kind of book can be introduced to the public, which in large part determines the content of the kind of book, a book that will appeal to a large public or potentially appear to a large public, will can find a network of distribution to be able to reach a public, as it were. The kind of books that I produced at that time and the kind of books that are being produced today have to find other ways of distributing themselves. And initially, when I was active, what I tried to do, because I was mostly involved with this problem, as opposed to the artists who were producing and participating in the project, was that I immediately felt that the best place to produce, to distribute these books, because there was no, at the time, printed matter didn't exist. Walter Koenig has just begun to do things like that. And there was actually the art dealers who were involved with the art at that time. And they both had the means and the reason, in a certain way, to be able to take on and eventually pay for the books that we were producing. And so it wasn't until much later, until the early 70s, I suppose, I can't give an exact date, that books, the artist book became sort of a category, if I can use it in that world. In that, I should differentiate between the books that we were making or trying to make and the traditional art books. The traditional art books, which could take many forms, were basically beautiful physical books. I mean, people were very... this was not something that particularly interested me. We were trying to do something else. We were trying to move, give the book the kind of space that a physical space had, and to be able to produce books in which the works were more integrated and specifically related to the books, I mean, the handling of a book, the experience of a book. At that time, I referred to it as primary and secondary information, which I've gone over. In other words, there were books in which the entire oeuvre of the works that were being dealt with were primary and basically completely contained in the work, as opposed to secondary books and catalogs in the art world, which are books which refer to other things which appeared at gallery, on walls, on museums, or whatever it was doing. what would be called a more traditional catalog. It seems that today the art book has become quite something else, and the activity that's going on here is like a very good instance of where possibly the book can go and how it can be used. I was very impressed by the prices of the books that were being offered here, because I always would like to know how someone could possibly live in producing kind of these books for 12 euros or Swiss francs, as the case may be. And in what way that we all involved with sort of creative activities spent sort of self-exploit ourselves. In other words, we provide all the energy and input and creative energy and hardly any recompense in the sense of, well, being able to earn a living and to live like, I wouldn't say normal people, but people who at least should have the opportunity to be able to live from their work, which is a fundamental idea. We were not quite able to do that, although I personally took the book as a very serious source of not, obviously, as an art, I won't use the word artistic project, but as a artistic object, but also as a very serious source of income. I mean, it's a way of earning a living that that although I was never be able to earn a living doing it, at least it provided the possibility that this could happen. And this is the kind of struggles that I think everyone making small additions, very, could call it specialized or artistic, I don't like the word artistic too much, but sort of specialized books in a range of different areas should be able to both think about and be able to realize in order to reach a public and to have a relationship with the world outside. So I am going to hold off for a moment.
I was just wondering if you could talk a bit about the aesthetics as well as the economics of the book and how the book was very important. I mean, Seth made very revolutionary projects with the book. As you're probably aware, Seth made some very revolutionary projects with books. I mean, like the Xerox book and his publication of Warren Tweener's Statements, where the relationship between the book and the exhibition became kind of integrated in a way that it hadn't previously, where in a sense the book became the site of the exhibition. And I think it's also, what you said is very interesting about economics of book making and book production and distribution, but I was also wondering if you could talk a bit about the kind of the aesthetics of it and how you envisaged, you know.
Yeah, I don't know if I can really talk about the aesthetics of the book. I don't even know if I'd want to talk about this. Because,
but what it meant to you to link these different sites then?
I don't know. It seemed that there was a conjuncture, a historical conjuncture, if you like, but also a personal conjuncture in my interest. As originally as a dealer and then later as an organizer, publisher, whatever. And between me and these kinds of interests and the artworks that were just being done by people like Lawrence, like Hubler, like a number of other people, which allowed us, and I say us, the artists as well as myself, to be able to produce another kind of product, if you like, you want to call it a product or something like this. And it sort of opened up the possibilities to many people after us, I suppose, to be able to just produce a book.
And it's an exhibition.
As an exhibition, or
but that's not
even
a record of an exhibition, but is the exhibition.
That was the intention at the time, and I think this is still more than possible. On the other hand, I think it's a little bit, well, it's been 40 years. I don't know if it has the same resonance, let's say, today that it probably had in 1968 or 69. But nevertheless, there are certainly other forms of activities within the book. I've always been a great fan of the book, and I should state it.
What about the Xerox book? And were you disappointed more copies of the Xerox book weren't Xeroxed or made?
Well, the Xerox books was never Xeroxed. The original projects were Xerox, and when I went to Xerox to hopefully find some money to produce this book, they were definitely not interested in this. And so we had it done by simply what was called at the time paper plate offset, which is a very cheap kind of offset printing, which we produced in 1,000 copies. The life of the book, when I left the United States, which was in 1972, I left. By that time, the printed matter had started up, and I left all my stock with them and then just went on to another life in a certain way. So I didn't follow the evolution or
you can tell, you can distinguish what's an original Xerox book because of that method of production.
Yes, occasionally I've been called upon to authenticate, not physically authenticate, because I really can't do that. But people coming in to dealers claiming that this was an original Xerox book. And if it was in Xerox, it couldn't be original. Because it was never done as a Xerox book. Although, when Danielle did a show at the Van Arbor Museum called Friesall the Wit, we loaned a copy of the book and allowed it to be copied by anybody who wanted it or something to do that, because I don't particularly find the product so particularly special, and it's blah, 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 the beautiful paper, and beautiful this. It has no value in that sense of its uniqueness. And, of course, you can often ask about this, leading to other questions about authenticity and value. What's the point in a certain way, or why certain things become fetish objects because they're unique? There's no particular interest to think of them as being physically important in what they were. What's probably important could be the moment in which they were created, but not so much the object being a fetishized, super-duper, fantastic, you know, the first edition of this or the first edition of that, which is something that never crept into my mind. We were just interested in doing exhibitions which I could afford to do or raise the money to be able to do. And that was that, and try to sell them. And it was clear at the beginning that I wanted to be able to share the sales of the book, or a percentage of the sale of the books, what would be called an artist royalty. But this really never happened in a way, because things trickled in. I mean, $2, $3.
Are you disappointed by the way in which documentation or what things that weren't fully considered to be works ontologically are now seen have become fetishized?
Yeah, but this is something totally outside of one's control, as it were. You know, the appreciation of value in the art world is determined by larger forces, economic for one, political, cultural. And why something, my publications or our publications as well as anything else, is why they become such fetish and important objects has to do with the larger society around them. And it also has to do, I'm losing my voice, it seems, but it also has to do with many other people being involved with the work of the artists who are involved with these projects. In other words, if I had done those books and died, and the artist didn't make anything else, I wouldn't be sitting here. I mean, that's the end of the story. There'd be no need for that. In other words, it's a very real historical continuum of sort of activities, younger generations, inspiring, et cetera, et cetera. And so why the Xerox book or the X book or whatever, or you could pick any painting you want necessarily, also falls in the same category of sort of art history making, as it were. That's a very complex project, though. No one really controls it in the way they want it.
How did the project really come about in terms of concept to transform? It was really still unique at the time to think of an exhibition as a book.
Yeah, I don't... I can make up a story. I mean, I don't really know. That's the kind of thing. Why did you fall in love with X or Y? I mean, tell me about that. I mean, what does that mean? Or, you know, why did you go here or go there? These are things that are very, very difficult to pin down. And I think much of art history is made up of the bullshit about the magic moment and, you know, all this kind of thing. I can't really think of a reason. I mean, I mentioned one particular thing concerning my interests and my position as a organizer, failed art dealer, whatever, and the kind of work that they were making, which consolidated, which was possible to result in a book that we know it, what conceptual or so-called conceptual art book was. But I can't think of anything in particular that brought these two entities together.
But you told me at that time also it was not called conceptual art and it was not called artist books.
Well, yeah, I've never liked the term. I never liked any of the terms. I don't like abstract expressionism either. I don't like any of the isms. I don't like...
So
the categories.
Diagram of isms there.
Yes. I don't like the categories. I don't like the hardening of the categories, let's call them. And,
but what I meant by that, you say, was not even really representative of what was going on in some ways.
That I don't know. You have to get involved sort of the typology or the taxonomy of, you know, how art movements evolve and things like that. There's always a lot of things going on and why this popped up then. I mean, I've always attributed it to a background of particularly the information age. Marshall McLuhan, although you don't see it in any of the work and directly in that, but you definitely see a capitalism moving towards information, whether in the form of advertising, whether in the form of Xerox machines, speak of the devil, or IBM machines, or mechanized work and things like this. So a lot of the value of information in the general society was very much around us at all times. Perhaps I would like to think you add the Vietnam War resistance, or the resistance to political dimension to, you know, it brought about a certain kind of rethinking of the problem of property, one of the things that certainly this art initially dealt with, which history has made into quite something else, was to get away from the commodity nature of art and things like that. And these are the things that a lot of people were discussing. I mean, dozens of people, not just so-called conceptual artists, were talking about how to break down these kind of barriers, the roles of all sorts of institutional critiques and things like this. So all this stuff was going on, and this is one thing that I personally was involved in with a group of artists. But I should also mention that the group of artists sort of became more enlarged in a way. Initially, it was the four artists of Wiener Jubler, Chris Suth, and Robert Barry, but my interest in exhibition making became very much more developed, I mean, very much broader. Do I say so much? But I can't think of any reason why it happened then, other than the social, cultural background underlying it. But I've never heard anybody speak about this. I don't think there's very few art historians who really bring it in this kind of toile de fond culturally, why it happened when it did. I think these things are very difficult to define, and a lot of art history is about, well, I'd say trying to define them, but also trying to define them in a very simplistic way. In the sense that there's always a lot of things going on. And when you look back at a moment, you don't have to look back, you just sit in this room, and you think about all the different ideas floating around, and this one doing this, and this one doing that, and this one doing that. And it's a very complex interrelationship of friendships, of ideas, stealing, borrowing, talking, I mean, a whole series of things, which happens in all these things. Part of art history, or maybe it's the goal of art history, is to make these very complicated social, cultural, aesthetic, if you like, movements into a nice, simple narrative. And part of the reason, I think, this is nothing particularly to do with my activities, our activities, is to produce great artists. If you understand, in other words, to take a very amorphous, a very moving, a very human configuration of people working together and talking and fighting and going to exhibitions and whatever people do, and things like this, and little by little to try to draw out the top of the pops like this. And sort of art history is about that. So initially you have a group of, say, 20 or 30 artists, and then you have a movement of like 20, 10, 15 people, and then you have four or five top of the pops, and then you have one, you know, which goes off and for some reason becomes the top, well, number one hit parade or something like this. And this kind of art history affects everybody. It affects us. It affects how you look at art, how you look back at art.
Yes, because looking back, we for instance, find quite few women involved in publishing.
Yes.
For instance.
So there's a lot. So it's a very different thing. But I don't think you should. I don't think it's possible, or let's say it's not very easy, to determine why things happen in a very rational way. People say, you know, people ask me, and I'm sure they ask lots of people, oh, what did you think of the first show of Pick a Name or something like this? Maybe I never even saw it. I mean, who knows? In other words, they present it, an important exhibition or an artist, whatever, or a moment, as some sort of magic moment. You know, see something, you see the light. And sometimes it can be like that. There's no doubt about it. But it's also true that you go through life seeing many different things, and they all don't register as as magic moments or a particularly special moment. But what does happen is, as you read back into history, and that is a function of history making, which is made by everybody, specifically maybe you can talk about art historians or something like this, they seem to focus on certain things that were important. But whether they were important at the time, I'm very skeptical of this kind of history. And I see art history, as I see human history in a way, as being formed of a lot of very different things going on at one time. And sort of the kind of narrative that leads you to very simplistic things. You know, I'm not a big fan of that. So I don't look back at these moments and say, oh, yes, I remember, blah, 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 blah. It was a great time and there's something like that. I don't have that kind of ideas. I have sort of a wash, you know, a broad image of a period of different people. I mean, you know, you have to remember the people who were involved with things, like included people running from Joseph Beuys to Heine Rutenbeck to Richard Tuttle there's a whole range of people which, you know, now you wouldn't even think in the same breath were involved with the same kinds of considerations. And although...
Can I ask the audience whether they want to ask questions?
Yeah, whenever you're ready.
Yeah,
it's okay.
Would you like to ask any questions? Are there any questions for Seth?
Yeah, maybe a stupid question, but you were talking about conceptual art, such movements. But do you think like a art block, a coalition, or things like that could have been an artistic movement, or why did it fail?
No, I don't. I mean, it's a particular...
Good question. Sorry.
No, it's... Today it could be. It could be an art project. I don't think, because I was involved with it to a certain degree, not as much as some people, but I attended the meetings and voted and talked about it and carried posters and stuff. But no, it was definitely not conceived of. It was considered more in the area of artists' rights, and that was its project. It also had to do, artists' rights, and, I mean, in a very banal, almost... sort of union-oriented kind of considerations. I mean, protecting artists so they can live. At that time in New York, for example, artists lived in studios, which were sort of converted sweatshops in a certain way. They were more or less illegal. They were tolerated. You know, they couldn't insure things, blah, 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 blah. There was all sorts of problems attached to that kind of living stuff. And that was the kind of issue that was going on. Or artists, when they get sick,
It was also about, there were also ethical things as well. I mean, the dispute at the moment.
Yeah, the museum manner.
Yeah, and the removal of the sculpture was also...
Tuckers,
yeah. Yeah, it was a big... So it also
yes, there was a lot of very dramatic... developments, you mentioned Museum Modern Art and the picketing and the mishandling of the Tacker sculpture, which triggered a lot of protest, of which I was involved in, and was dozens or hundreds of other people. All these things were going on, power questions, which side are you on, buddy, and things like this. Artists were thinking about this. But I don't necessarily find or remember there was any direct filiation between sort of the political climate and political activism and the art that were being made. There's very few artists who I remember as being actively engaged. Everyone was against the war. Everyone gave free art for auctions to raise money against the war. Everybody, right, left, and center, I might say, everybody, because the overwhelming feeling in the art world was very much against the war, even people who are definitely right-wing artists.
I'm just wondering also, Weffer, do you have any other questions?
This is a lot.
This is a lot, but does anyone have a...
lot to throw at you.
Yeah, just one question, maybe relating to what you were saying before. what is your point of view? I mean, what you're talking about is informed by what you have done, what you have done in that at that period of time in the 60s, 70s. And what do you think now should be considered to this relation between time and like time and production, like concerning books, I'm a bit lost. When at that time you were saying at that time when you were producing those books, you were just thinking about making those projects happen and those books, and then you said that then it took another meaning. Through time and history.
Yeah.
And what you like informed by that? Where are we now?
That I can't say. Particularly one because I'm not actively involved. Looking, you have to remember that the world of art has changed dramatically. Not the least of which is quantitatively, it's become huge. Absolutely, totally huge. I mean, you know, in New York, in my generation, or you go to Cologne, you know, you walk down two or three streets, you see virtually all the shows. I mean, that was the end of that. It takes you an hour or something to do it. Maybe, well, not quite 10 minutes, but now you can go into one building in New York and you spend a day or two there just walking up. So there's sort of a very important qualitative difference in the size of the art world, and with it, its connection with the larger, let's call it capitalist society, which has, digested the art world, and art world has taken on many of its values in a way, in the term, not just money, or the importance of money and fame and celebrityhood and blah, 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 blah. But also how we look at art and why we consider some things more important than other things. I mean, the kind of values that bear on these kind of judgments have become very different than they were when I was growing up, let's say, or when I was active, which was in my mid-20s or something like this. It's absolutely impossible to know what's happening now. First place, I don't think it's much more difficult in the sense that there are so many more actors. And this could be good. I mean, it's not necessarily bad. That the time involved to be able to see, just see, even hear, but to see, hearing is a lot easier, you know, save shoe leather and stuff like that, and just press a few buttons. You can see. But has become dramatically bigger, so I don't quite... You have to take it much more. It's almost impossible to envelope, you know, make a decision or make a comment about the art world, except for its, let's call it the business side or the sort of the economic side. There it's become much simpler.
I agree.
Yeah, in a way.
We will come back to more questions to Seth later in the discussion. I will now let's
Hi, my thanks for your great talk, Seth. I really enjoyed that, and Seth talks a lot about the book, and my talk is about the copy, the hard copy, as it were here, which I like this context for talking about copying. I'm a lawyer and a curator, so I have this kind of schizophrenic life where, and it's quite interesting that I do projects where the two practices, which often look very different, can intersect and overlap, and I'm going to discuss particularly a project that I produced with Superflex at the Van Arbe Museum, which was called Free Solowit, and I'm going to distribute copies to you, which is, I think was quite interesting for the audience to see. Do you want to just kind of go up? Because I find it quite hard to do talks about images, so there's at least the images in distribution. And this project, Free Solowit, it was a project within an exhibition which I made with Superflex called In Between Minimalism, which was at the Van Arbe Museum for earlier this year, which was an exhibition looking at things like reproduction, what production meant to in minimalist art, and also in conceptual art and the relations between these different movements and society generally. And Free Solowit was a very interesting project because its premise is what would it be like if you produced copies inside a museum of a minimalist artwork and then gave these out to the public, members of the public, free of charge. So it transformed the museum into a kind of factory of production, and it looked at it took a specific work by Solowit called Untitled. It was a wall structure from 71. And the machine was literally transformed into three tables like this, in which you had metal workers banging out these copies of a very kind of characteristic trademark style Solowit, which was a kind of zigzag wall structure, geometric structure. You can see it in the book. And Solowit famously said that the idea is the machine that makes the artwork. And in a sense, what Superflex said, well, what would it mean if you didn't switch the machine off, if you allowed it to run? And so inside the museum, you had like perfect replicas made of this metal white structure. And members of the public could sign up and take these free through a kind of random lottery-style distribution system. So if you were lucky and your name was pulled out of a box, then you'd get your free Solowit, which was about 3 meters wide, and then you had to take it home. So you had all these members of the audience carrying out outside the museum hard copies of a Solowit. And I think it's a very cool project because it kind of collapsed into one space the realm of production, of exhibition and distribution. So all of these temporalities and modes were linked together. And it looked at the key question is the production of value. How do we value artworks? Why is an object fetishized in this way? Why is it valued in this way? And also, what does it mean to reproduce a particular artwork? And what was nice about this, interesting about the project, is in a sense it was drawing an analogy and a parallel between two systems of authorship and regimes of production and originality. The art system, with its notion of the original, of the unique work, of the trace of the artist, of the objecthood. And then on the other hand, the copyright system. And copyright law regulates the production of copies through a whole system which says that it's lawful to reproduce certain things in certain ways for a certain time and not others. But copyright relates to what's known as the kind of intellectual property, the intangible things in the work, whereas we're talking about intangible value and material value of the object itself. So in a way, Superflex was like posing the question of how these regimes of value work. And it was interesting for me because I wasn't just a curator, I was also a lawyer, so I had to negotiate with the Solowit estate, because the point for Superflex was to make this project inside the museum without the prior consent of the Solowit estate. So in theory, there was a kind of act of copyright infringement. Because basically, I don't know how familiar you are with the rules of copyright law, but copyright law really says that if a certain image or a work is protected as original, and its copyright lasts for a long time, it's the lifetime of the author plus 70 years, then if you copy that work, you require or a substantial part of that work, you required a permission, the authorization of the copyright owner, which is normally the author, but then it can also be third parties like the artist estate. And one of the interesting points in this project, important points of the project, was that for Solowit, he was very open about copying. He said that, you know, I would feel poorer if other artists didn't copy my ideas. So he almost proposed a kind of system of shared ownership, of shared value, where he believed passionately in the sharing of content. And for Superflex's very kind of leftist copyright skeptic movement, they saw a kind of analogies with Solowit's ideas about reproduction and sharing of content with the digital age and the free software movement. So it's begging the question, really, that if what locks down this content? Why is it controlled in this way? And it was very interesting because with the Solowit estate accepted that it was legitimate to make this act of copying distribution within the context of the museum. And in fact, their main concern was that people might misunderstand that the works were original Solowit works when they were released. But we pointed out that that couldn't be the case because Solowit works require certificates of authenticity, and nobody had a certificate who signed up for a free Solowit. So I think that this notion that minimalism and conceptual art, in a sense, looked forward to was the kind of possibility of infinite reproduction in some ways. I mean, you have it with a photocopier of the Seth Siegler, of the conceptual movement, the kind of the paradigm of conceptual art, a metaphor of conceptual art is the copy machine. And in a way, the photocopier and then the copy machine of minimalism is the factory workshop. And both of these artistic processes, movements in the 60s, raise this possibility of where does reproduction actually end? And there's something very arbitrary about looking at minimalist artworks and seeing one of them or two of them or three of them, when in fact the potentiality for repetition is implicit. So I think that the Superflex project revealed these kind of contradictions and of the way in which both systems, both the art system and in a way the copyright system, control the way in which authorship and originality are regulated and how people can use and access cultural content. And so for the museum, it was a way of almost expanding its walls and enabling content to leave the museum and be shared by the public, even though, you know, temporarily.
Thank you. Are there some questions on the project? I mean, Daniel, I think curator law of shows that always deal with the issue of copyright and law and artists working with contracts, and this is so one example. And
yeah,
I've
done many projects on this kind of basis, but I think it's interesting to think about a specific project here, and I just wonder whether any of you had any questions.
Do you have some question on this art and law related issues? We can go into the discussion with Dexter Semister and Stuart and David.
Okay, we'll try to keep this brief. Maybe we'll have a bit of time for questions or talking afterwards. Seth, when he was talking, he made the really crucial distinction between primary information and secondary information in a book, right? And so, in particularly in an art book, and secondary information would be information in which points off to another source, perhaps the work in the gallery or the work wherever it exists outside of the book. And Seth indicated a preference for primary information, for work that works directly on the page of the book, and that's the thing you need in order to receive the full experience. And that chimes very well with, I mean, obviously that's a kind of foundational idea for a lot of the things that we're interested in doing. So I wanted to say something quickly about what's on the wall here. So along this wall, along just this wall here, are a series of works which originally appeared on the pages of .. magazine. This is a magazine that Stuart founded 10 years ago, and which has been is now in its 20th and final issue, and that together as Dexter Sinister we publish. These works all appeared originally as illustrations for articles for text within that magazine, and they were typically kind of low-grade reproductions. They were black and white. They were, because we don't produce the magazine at a particularly high level of production, nor were we interested in that, per se. Somewhere along the line, well, maybe 6 years ago, Stuart made an effort to collect some of the pieces, some of the original works that appeared as reproductions first. And this is kind of a backwards way out of the primary and secondary information setup. So these works, which are now, I mean, I guess you could call them the primary works. Sometimes they are one-offs or whatever. I think these are actually more or less pointers back to the articles and the where the work actually worked, which was on the page of the magazine in the service of the text that did it. So this collection ends up being more of a kind of living, accumulated, practical archive that comes out of publishing, out of the act of publishing, rather than an exhibition that's formed and assembled onto the wall.
I'd kind of rather respond to any questions at this point if you have any. I mean, I can go on to talk about what Dexter Sinister was in relation to from the sort of year 2005 onwards in relation to what Seth was talking about. Or I can sort of go on and talk about a bigger project that we have in mind that this is part of called the Serving Library. But first, I'd just...
What is...
Sure.
Yeah.
You both?
I'll yes, try. Exactly.
Okay.
So who is Dexter? Yes. And where's Sinister?
They're both here, but they vary.
You ask.
So Dexter Sinister was basically a title that we use. It was supposed to be a publishing imprint. It means left and right in heraldic vocabulary. And over the past 5 years became a sort of funny triangle of activities. One of those was a kind of regular design studio. One was to act as a bookstore and a distribution hub. We have a basement space in the Lower East Side in New York that most of the work that we do emanates from. And the third, which was the sort of most surprising, was to end up with Dexter Sinister as a kind of moniker, a kind of title, pseudonym that we worked under increasingly in sort of gallery and museum situations, of which this is a pretty good example of a sort of in-between space in which we work. And Dexter Sinister was really founded upon the idea of trying to reconsider what it meant to publish in 2005, 2006, on the basis of having worked for 10 or 15 years in arts publishing, where there seemed to be a lot of surplus and waste, not only in material terms of ink and paper, but also in time and energy that we were kind of increasingly involved in. And so the idea was just to set up quite consciously and deliberately and publicly as a kind of model to try and reclaim back some of the involvement from the start of those projects where you can reasonably influence how much or how little waste is involved. I'm not sure, actually, over the past 5 years how much of that directive we ended up following. But, of course, you set up things like that and then you end up going down different routes. But what did happen that was interesting for us is to set up this store. And the store happened through initially just wanting to have a more efficient means of distribution, this journal that we made, which originated now 10 years ago in the year 2000. Because of the ways in which printing economics are set up, and things to do with the quality of materials and so forth, we always ended up printing in Europe, and it always took a remarkably long time for the magazine to reach us in the US. And so the shop aspect really started as a way of getting a printer to send us a box in advance of it being more regularly shipped, and to kind of send out that message to the sort of circle of people we knew would be interested to get it. And the shop really just started that way: a box of books and a bunch of friends or a bunch of people that we knew were interested, and very quickly started to justify itself in economic terms by paying for the space by paying for the space in which we were operating from. And since then, we started including other books that we were involved in as designers or editors, or sometimes in terms of the content itself. We gradually included similar books and other kinds of publications from friends of ours, which seemed to make sense. And eventually also, although quite rarely, maybe works of literature that seemed to make sense within this setup. We're talking about a very, very small bookstore. There's probably never been more than maybe 70 different books at any one time, but a number of copies of each of those 70, so it looks like more than that. Six bookshelves, which are basically the same as the three that are here in this side of the room. And the one thing I really wanted to say was that, as Seth kind of implies, Being any kind of independent publisher requires quite a lot of inventiveness as to how you can make that work economically. And for us, it was a very skewed kind of system whereby, as kind of working designers, for want of a better term, we could reasonably write into whatever contracts of whatever we were getting paid for designing or editing or writing to get a certain number of books as well as fees. So we'd get maybe 50, 100, 200 copies of the book we were working on, which meant that we didn't really have any overheads in terms of publishing for the store. And this is really why the bookstore ended up being a viable proposition as a space. Okay, moving on to jumping from the past and kind of bouncing on the present of this exhibition and launching into the future. This is part of a setup that we're currently establishing called the Serving Library. And the Serving Library is easiest to describe as taking four or five or six aspects of what we've developed over the past 5 years and exploring them in a more deliberate, planned, maybe responsible, maybe mature way. One of those things would be a physical library of books, which is the thing that's in the room over here, or is the beginning of the thing. We're touring this idea over a number of different institutions, and we're trying to get each institution that we kind of stop at and exhibit at to add to this collection, both in terms of the objects and in terms of the books, with a view to eventually being in a single physical location that is actually to some degree a public library. So the books and the objects are both founded in the journal, in dot, dot, dot. The books being the most commonly referred to references by our writers over the past 10 years, and those could be works of literature, they could be sociological or philosophical or whatever. And the objects, as David said, are a kind of source material of illustrations that have appeared in the journal. The other aspects are a digital online library of PDFs to be kind of freely dispersed and downloaded, and also some kind of residency program which would essentially involve some kind of editor librarian who's in control, or sorry, in charge of the objects and the books at any given point, and that would be a kind of rotating position. So, and maybe the best way to sum that up, to sum the Serving Library up, is to say it's more of a projected institution that's interested in kind of archiving something that we developed quite haphazardly over the past 5 years in terms of a shop and a space.
Well, thank you very much. Are there further questions from the audience to Dexter, Sinister, to Stuart or David? No more questions? I guess, do you like to add something?
No.
Or to okay. Seth, or shall we continue?
Yeah.
Well, I offer that we could just continue informally the discussion among the audience, and you can find the magazine at the entrance as well as the edition. There is also an extract from the magazine with an interview presenting the collection that you can find in the entrance. And so thank you very much for coming.
I have a question.
Yes. Go ahead, Seth.
Just remembered it. What do the people in this room think about their book production and how it affects the world? And is it just a question of making a book and putting it? We used to put all our books under the bed because they never sold or something like this. But what is the intention once your book is produced? Because one of the things I've always found publishing, not just art books, but also political books, also books on the history of textiles and other things, is that books are one of the great, still is one of the great cultural media in the world. It is something that is accessible practically to anybody. I'm not just, you know, whether it's 5 pages or 500 pages, someone, practically anybody, at least in a middle class or even middle lower class, could produce a book. And one of the things that I have learned or tried to understand and try to conquer is how to get rid of these things and how to get it out into the world. And do the people here who are producing books, are they happy just to produce a book? And what do they think about getting it out there? Is there anybody commenting?
Anyone
can help me about this?
You're editing multiple functions.
hoping to sell enough to pay the printer.
Are there any new strategies and things like this which for people?
Well, I think one of the common points that remains from your time to today is that you have a certain autonomy and a form to some extent of control how you want the work to be formulated, expressed and circulated with publishing. And like the laptop radio we're using tonight, it's a nomadic object. It's autonomous, can circulate easily, be sent. There is an issue you brought up also of storage, distribution, so which are still very complex, the relation with the publisher, the identity of the publisher versus the identity of the artist or the relation with graphics. So there are still, but as well there is possibilities as you're using, for instance, publishing reference text online as PDF or there are also as well new possibilities. What I observe very clearly is that in the last years, there's been an emergence of so-called artist books and multiple artist book fair, because it's a privileged medium for circulating the work. So that still is so.
Yeah.
And
I'd say there is a major difference in that. Because those things are available on the net and are available as PDFs and are available in libraries, the way that maybe I'm pessimistic and a bit cynical, but the way that the books can still be made today as physical objects depends to a great part on the fact that their status as fetish and as collectible commodities has changed over the past few years, has changed over the past few decades. And without the seemingly insane person who will look at a stack of 20 books to find the one that has the least defect and that they can put in plastic as soon as they go home and not read it, without those people, I don't think there would be any artist books or multiples today. We count on those people to survive today, because people who are interested in content, above all, have other and much cheaper means to get them.
That's a great point. Like the Free Solowit book, is you can get it in hard copy form, but it's also freely available to be downloaded on the website of Superflex. So that's pure information. I think that's a great point.
And it's really not something I'm necessarily happy about, but it's certainly something that I work with knowingly.
Are there more people who would like to share their experience in terms of publishing? No? Well, I also observe that for many artists, for instance, working with performance, like Alan Capro used to work, publish some script for his performance, is still something that is very much used as props for performance, for instance. So I think today it explores many, many, many forms. It could be, you know, from something that inscribed itself into the practice as well as traces or anticipation towards the work. Yeah.
But a lot of this production, we see it, for example, particularly recently with musicians selling their scores, or maybe artists making prints when they really are involved with something else, is to sort of pay the bills. I mean, that's mm-hmm. perfectly clear that this has become that kind of a kind of production. And there's many people who come to mind who make work that's impossible to sell, either by virtue of this materiality or its size or who knows what it is. But you can always buy a print for something for $200, and that is used to pay the bills, as it were. In other words, there's that kind of dichotomy in terms of raising it. Carl Andre once said, and rightly so, that the art market tries to create rarity when you don't have to have rarity. And that's like a perfectly good idea.
He's benefited from that, hasn't he?
Any artist has exactly, this is what the art market does. It creates an object which is rare, which doesn't have to be rare.
In relation to your own publishing, could you consider releasing these books today, for instance, as PDF?
Oh, no, I have. The group in New York, Primary Information, is scanning and downloading all my books. So I'm very happy to get rid of them. But that doesn't mean anything. I mean, I'm over the hill. I mean, I don't expect to make any money from this. Whatever history has, whatever the hand of history has dealt me, it doesn't affect me in that way. So I'm very happy to get rid of all these things and have people be able to download a Xerox book or whatever. I mean, all the publications.
Still, people would still want 1,000. Yeah.
Exactly. It doesn't change. I don't know if many people are aware, there's an American publisher called Dover Publishing. And Dover is a huge enterprise. And what they do is they print books which are out of copyright. But, you know, the fact that you...
Luck.
No. And, well, there's lots. I mean, there's many books, 16th century, 17th century, 18th century. But I don't think them printing the Gutenberg Bible makes the Gutenberg Bible any less valuable. And I don't think a PDF today affects it. There is a problem here if you want to be able to make information available, as we're becoming more and more used to. I mean, whether it's news or information or whatever. I think this is a very positive, progressive attitude. You still have the problem of how does an artist live? I mean, how does a society pay for its artists, and how do they do it? I think many artists, and this is just very speculative, would be very happy to be able to do their work and receive whatever, some kind of, you know, a fee apart, whatever, so that they don't have to worry about doing this, and so they don't have to make objects that necessarily correspond to
what the market wants.
What the market wants, even if they could.
On that point, I'd like to say, can I?
No,
I'm just being asked to. I'm being ordered to say thank you to everybody for attending this and participating, and thank you to everyone who's involved in speaking on the panel. Thank you. Thank you, Seth.
Yeah, thank you for coming tonight. And so we're all here if you have a further question to our guests. Thank you very much.
I really love that idea. You made it so clear, both of you.